she did, and we stayed. Maybe she felt bad for us. Maybe she thought it was a good thing to have other NYCers out there on the road. Or really, and probably, she knew that the audience hated us so much that by the time she hit the stage, it would be fucking glorious, like an ice cream sundae after the dentist. I totally do not know Madonna. Not then and not now. I wish I were friends with her. How fucking cool would that be? And it's not really a stretch. I mean, we had a bunch of people in common, right? We hung out at the same places. But maybe it's that thing where girls are just more advanced than boys, and even though I was like 19, I seemed more like a 13-year-old scrub, a pimply freshman. And I kind of was. And she for sure was way beyond whatever I was into. She seemed like a grown-up who traveled and knew what wine to get and had friends with nice teeth whose picture you'd see in the party pages of some magazine like Elle or something. She for sure did not have to keep us on that tour, but she did. And it was huge for us. We learned so much from being out there. What a tour was like. What a real show was like. It was eye-opening and inspiring to us to be around a performer who was so awesome and totally professional and who was out to handle her business and just have fun. Madonna, thank you. Madonna Tour FYIs and BTWs by Adam Horovitz. Read by Ben Stiller. IHOP. The first night of the tour was in Seattle, then down to Portland. Oh, speaking of Portland, we got there late at night after the drive from Seattle, and we were hungry. So we wandered around downtown trying to find a place to eat. Mike was running ahead to look around each corner to see if anything was still open. He ran up to a corner, looked around, turned to us, and from far away we hear Mike scream, IHOP! He jumped in the air, hands waving above his head, landed, and crumpled to the ground. He twisted his ankle so bad we had to take him to the ER.
Disclaimer, I may or may not have been very excited and or very stoned, and I definitely was very hungry.
I blame the 80s for this. If it was now, we would have yelped the shit out of Late Night Spots Portland. We'd have slowly and calmly wazed to a restaurant and had delicious pierogies, instead of almost eating at the International House of Pancakes. We also had no idea what it was like to be on tour. Night after night, next new place, away from home. No idea where to get food, do laundry, get a shitload of quarters to call home with. It was the final days of just having to find shit out as it happened. Showbiz. For us, just being in hotels was awesome. Room service was a very new and exciting thing. So much so that I ordered escargot to the room in our fancy hotel because, why not? The short story here is that we were all hanging out in a room, I got my escargot, and for whatever reason, I was eating them in bed while wearing only underwear. Why? I don't know. But again, why not? I was so overexcited that I spilled a plate of steaming hot snails, garlic, salt, butter, and oil onto my bare legs. So, there. It's been properly documented. You guys can stop laughing at me now. Tasty Licks. Roger Clayton, from L.A.'s legendary and influential DJ production crew Uncle Jam's Army, filled in for the first two shows after Rick left the tour. In the middle of one of the L.A. shows, Uncle Jam came out from behind the turntables and was doing a kind of air guitar thing to the audience. He was also making that, "I'm a nasty shredder on this axe," face. And it was all over. It was just a thing that people do, but not us. Not at A7. I know it's a totally childish way to make a business-slash-professional decision. We could have talked about it with him and moved forward, but it was an unfortunate pantomime that could not be unseen. So we parted ways. Everything you'd hoped it would be. Just being out of New York City really for the first time was thrilling. Being on tour, seeing cities I'd heard of but never been to, like Seattle, Portland, Miami, Cleveland, Chicago. Places with unpronounceable-to-me names like La Jolla. Oh, speaking of Miami, did Madonna have a wild party at some crazy mini-mansion when we were in Miami? Yes, of course she did. Was it all you could imagine and want it to be? Yes, it was. Was John Sally getting freaky in a hot tub? Yes, of course he was. Pickle Man. One morning in Cincinnati, I woke up and had a couple weird, itchy splotches on my arm. I didn't pay them any mind until the end of the night. After the show, I noticed that they had spread over my entire body. I had some kind of insane allergic reaction hive breakout. Having a face that looks like an itchy pickle is not a good look when trying to talk to girls after the show. The next day we were given the address of a doctor and got lost. We asked somebody waiting at a bus stop for directions and he said, "Oh, I don't know. I'm a little..." He pointed at his head and made the "I'm crazy" signal with his finger. We kept going. When we finally got to the doctor, he gave me a shot of what he called adrenaline. I was tweaking for about 2 hours straight, and then the hives went away. Not the kind of sexy or raucous details you were looking for in a book about a band. Hollywood swinging. We'd never been to L.A. before, and somehow we hooked up with a friend of a friend, Glenn E. Friedman. Glenn kind of grew up in L.A. and decided to be our tour guide. Glenn is vegan, but for whatever reason, he took us to Fatburger our first night in town. I got a fried egg on my burger. Glenn kept referring to eggs as liquid flesh. We made fun of him. He made fun of us. He cried from laughter, and we became friends for years. I think punk rock tipped the scale over veganism for Glenn because the next night, he took us to a grimy outdoor hot dog place called Okie Dog. It was some kind of L.A. punk rock landmark because X did something there, or Circle Jerks, or the Germs, or the Go-Go's. I can't remember. But the important thing is, an Okie Dog is a burrito stuffed with beans, cheese, two hot dogs, and pastrami, and it's fucking delicious. When we were in L.A., Madonna had a big party to celebrate the success of Like a Virgin. So we were there, drinking free drinks and loving it. Now, growing up in New York, you would occasionally see a famous person on the street. But this was for real Hollywood. We went with our new friend, Glenn, who's a great photographer, and he's taking pictures of us with, like, Sean Penn, E.G. Daily, Weird Al. The most random list of, like, oh, shit, that person? We gotta get our picture taken with them. Pre-selfie, pre-self-conscious. It was fucking fantastic. And, like, so totally L.A., for sure. Tapes. I brought more cassette tapes with me on tour than clothing. The other thing I brought was a massive box, or boombox, as the kids never used to say. Because I brought the box, I was usually in charge of the music. That, and also because I can get a little control freaky sometimes when it comes to song selection. We listened to a ton of music on that tour, either on the box or on the Lincoln Continental stereo. Two selections come to mind as standouts. 1. Forward, a Greensleeves Records reggae compilation. We listened to the shit out of that shit. In particular, the musical compositions Fatty Boom Boom by Ranking Dread and everyone's favorite Bathroom Sex by the one and only General Echo. The music is phenomenal and the lyrics are about as abstract as you can deal with. 2. Good Times, Bad Times, Led Zeppelin. We were just letting our guard down about listening to classic rock and, well, Led Zeppelin was fucking greater than great. That song being blasted out of speakers is similar to dipping lobster into melted butter. Songs are like markers in time. You hear them, and your brain catalogs where you're at while they're playing. Fatty Boom Boom was playing while we drove through the intersection of Franklin Avenue and Cahuenga Boulevard that Los Angeles summer night in 1985, an intersection I would drive through nearly 486 times just a few years later. The hottest party in L.A. On the first night we ever spent in Los Angeles, we saw Freddie Boom Boom Washington twice. He was in an open Jeep-type car. I'm going to say it was a Suzuki Samurai because I want him to be in one.
Fun fact. I wish I were in a Suzuki Samurai right now. A hot pink one with a top down blasting either Supersonic by J.J. Fad or Cars That Go Boom by La Trim, high as a kite.
We were only a few nights into the Madonna tour and we ended up in Los Angeles with a couple nights off. Not always, but sometimes when you're in a band on tour, you find out about stuff that's happening in the town you're currently in. People want you to be at their thing, their bar, club, house party. Weird people and their parties gravitate toward you, and you to them. So one of these nights in L.A., somehow, we meet this guy named Ricky Rackman. I really don't remember how or why we hooked up with him, but we did. He was like an L.A. version of a dude from Queens. He wasn't a burnout. He was more like a metalhead with a hustle. A couple of years later, he became an MTV VJ for a show called Headbangers Ball. He kept saying that he was going to hook up the hottest party in L.A., and it was going to be in our shitty hotel room at our shitty hotel, the Franklin Plaza Suites. He just kept saying he was going to get all these girls to come down, and that it was going to be hot. A word that was only spoken in New York City when referencing the temperature, unless you were making fun of an L.A. person. No one showed up. It was the three of us, this dude Ricky Rackman, and his friend. It was one of those parties where it's a bust, so you split and try to find something else to do. I think we left them there in our room because we really wanted to not be there anymore. It was not hot.
You Should Loop That by Adam Horovitz, read by LL Cool J. After we got home from the Madonna tour, we had nothing to do but nothing. On a typical night, I could walk over to Mike's new place on Barrow Street, or I could go to Yap's cool new ground floor apartment in Brooklyn Heights. And I guess I was in the mood for a road trip because I chose the latter. So I took the train to Clark Street, walked past the bagel place where all the cool girls from St. Anne's High School work, hit the deli on the corner of State and Henry for a couple of 40s of Ballantine on my way. You know Ballantine Ale with the puzzle on the cap? And I got the Yowks. Weirdly, Yowk was the super for the building. He would occasionally get calls from tenants asking them to come look at the radiator or check to see if their fridge or window or what have you was broken. He had zero qualifications for that job other than he could kind of just about do anything. It was dramatically different from 59 Christie Street. It was a tiny place, but it was clean, very grown up. It had a nice little backyard, and if you've never been to New York City, a backyard here means a 4-square-foot area outside your apartment that's not the sidewalk or fire escape. It's kind of an apartment where you drink wine from a wine glass. Anyways, I get there, and Yowk has a tape deck up on the counter in the kitchen. Not a cassette deck, but a quarter-inch reel-to-reel tape deck. I didn't even know he had one. So he'd pull the tape out of the machine, wound it around a mic stand in a wooden chair close to the reel-to-reel. When he pressed play, the tape came out one side of the tape deck, went tightly around the mic stand, then the chair, then back into the other end of the machine. He had the intro drum beat to Led Zeppelin's When the Levee Breaks going around and around his kitchen. The sound and the visual were so magical to me. It was like he was on some Doug Henning shit. He said that he recorded the intro part of the record onto the tape and then edited just that intro part and wanted it to keep going around and around like what a DJ would do with breakbeats. So what I'm saying is, Yowk was on to tape loops before You Should Loop That was an ubiquitous phrase. He told me that he'd heard about Hendrix and Sly Stone doing tape loops and he wanted to try it. Where'd he hear about it? There was no Google or YouTube. No library had a section on beats. He must have seen the Latin Rascals editing at Shakedown Studios and thought, can I do that? I just try to make that little drum beat edit keep going around and around to see what happens. What Yowk was working on that day became Rhyming and Stealing, the first song on our first album.
London 86 by Adam Horovitz, read by Jarvis Cocker. So, early 1986, we all go to London. Def Jam signed a distribution deal with CBS UK, and there's going to be a big party to launch his hot new rap record label into the United Kingdom. So me, Adam, Mike, Rick, Russell, and another Def Jam recording artist, LL Cool J, fly to the UK to make it happen. Driving from the airport into London takes, like, a long-ass time. Like in that Jam song, London Traffic. But seeing the city for the first time is so fucking cool. Actual fish and chips places. Just like you thought they'd be. Tons of curry houses. Big British taxis. Tiny winding streets. You guys, there really is an actual electric avenue in Brixton. We finally get to the hotel and have nothing to do for a while, so we go out. Walk around. Do what people do. Get snacks. But since we're away from home, we get a ton of local snacks. You know how you do that when you're somewhere else. Like, I should probably get all 4 different bags of potato chips because they don't have those styles back home. It actually worked out this time because I got fucking chicken tikka masala flavoured chips. Sorry, I mean flavoured crisps. We're in England. Back home, we'd call the place we got the snacks from either the deli or the bodega. Here, it's called the shops. Gonna go round to the shops. Pop down to the shops. Corner shop. Everyone's got a cool British accent like on Monty Python or The Young Ones. We're spending pounds and pence. The shop people are a little rude to you because they can tell you're American, but that's kind of how you want them to be. One of the snacks we got was something called a Scotch egg. I don't know if you know what a Scotch egg is, but as we learned, it's a hard-boiled egg wrapped in sausage meat, breaded, then fried. Looking out the hotel room window, we see a British gentleman right out of central casting walking down the street, maybe like 60 years old, wearing a nice black suit and a bowlerish-style black hat. A proper gentleman. So, of course, the first thing that comes to your mind is, I wonder if, from up here, can I hit that guy with this Scotch egg? I mean, throw in a bag of chips, sorry, crisps, out of a fifth-floor window at someone doesn't make sense. It would take a while to get down there. It's an odd object to throw, and obviously the wind would be a factor. But a Scotch egg is perfect. Kids, I'm neither encouraging nor condoning this behaviour. I'm just letting you know what happened on our trip to England. We're in London for a few days to work, do some interviews, meet the people at the UK record label, etc. But that was daytime. Night, we were on our own. Our friend from New York, photographer John Chures, was friends with Mick Jones from The Clash. He worked with them a little bit and hooked it up for us to hang out with him one night. At his fucking house. I'd like to preface this by letting you know that this was one of my favourite nights. Ever. It was one of those times where you can't believe this is actually happening to you. But in a really good way. So, we go to Mick Jones's house. He lived in a normal house. Not the kind you'd think one of The Clash would live in. It wasn't a dark and depressing tiny British house like in Quadrophenia. His house was grown up and fancy. Three or four floors, nice furniture, paintings and shit. And by the way, he is one of the nicest people in the world. We meet, hang out, have a little tea, a couple of beers, and then he shows us his studio in the basement. Not a practice space, but a nice little studio with all kinds of equipment. While Mick Jones is showing us a guitar of his, Yauch asks him to play Clash City Rockers. I don't know what possessed him to do that, but I mean, fuck yeah, I wanted that to happen. He kind of laughed and said that he forgot how to play it. And so Yauch took the guitar and taught Mick Jones how to play the song. Yes, Mick Jones from the fucking Clash. To quote my friend Bridget, story doesn't end there. Oh, wait. Someone's at the door. Yep. It's Joe fucking Strummer. Our new close friend, Mick Jones, had said some people were coming over. And maybe we could have some beers, hang out, and go see a movie. We could have either gone back to the hotel to eat, then sleep, or done this. Tough call. Now Joe Strummer's here, and we're all drinking Red Stripe Crucial brews, which are delicious. And the doorbell rings again. It's fucking Johnny fucking Rotten. He's with this cool-ass German lady who was the mum of Ari Up from the Slits, and we are now officially drunk and freaking out in Mick Jones's living room. We're getting ready to go and see a movie, and one more person shows up on our way out. Take a guess. Could be any fucking body, right? It is one of the coolest people in the world. Ever. Paul Simonon. Oh. The movie we're about to go and see is called Reanimator. A great movie. Not quite on a par with Terrorvision, but still a fine, fine film. Now, picture yourself with your two best friends, real tipsy, driving around the streets of London at night in two cabs with basically the fucking Clash and Johnny Rotten. Stopping at red lights, laughing, screaming, and throwing things at each other out the window. I mean, just a few years ago, these people made music that changed our lives. We absolutely and totally fucking love them. And now, we're getting drunk with them, and we're on our way to go to see a slasher movie together in London. We were getting our incidentals paid for by the record label, which means free room service. Obviously, nothing is free. We'd soon learn that. Wait, they said that the flights and the hotels were paid for. You mean they're just going to charge it back to us later? So one night, we have some people over to our hotel and order a ton of food and drink. By now, it's really late, so we figured the right thing to do before going to bed was to order a fish entree and some salad, break into Rick Rubin's room, and slip it all under his sheets while he's sleeping. I can't remember for sure, but I think we put a big plant or small tree on Russell Simmons while he was sleeping too. I don't know if it still works, but if you know what hotel room someone's staying in, you can go down to the front desk, looking really sleepy and out of it, and tell them that you're that person in room whatever, and you somehow locked yourself out of the room, and can you please have an extra key to let yourself back in? This was something we made a steady practice of. Chuck Eddy, where you at? So now we've thrown all kinds of snacks at British pedestrians, had a big party, broken into other guests' rooms, and, well, the long and short of it is, we found out the next morning that we were banned for life from the wonderful chain of Hilton hotels.
Actually, Adam, it was Holiday Inns.
We had to move on. No big deal. There's plenty of other places to stay in London. I feel like I'm telling you all about a vacation I went on. But it felt just like that. Every day of this London trip, something amazing and memorable happened. We met a ton of new people and hung out with some of the great ones, like Don Letts. For some reason, he likes us and gives us some dancehall reggae mixtapes that changed the way we thought about making music. Through another New York friend, Peter Doherty, we go to a recording studio to hang out with this little-known band maybe you've heard of, called Madness. We were so overwhelmed and excited and jet-lagged and drunk from drinking snakebite and black and tans in the studio that me, Adam and Mike passed out asleep on a couch in the corner of the recording studio.
A snakebite, of course, is lager and hard cider mixed, and a black and tan is pale lager and dark lager mixed.
I think all the stimulation of the past few days got to us, and we just shut down. Everything on the trip led up to the big launch party for Def Jam. The party ended up being like the finale of a movie, when everything gets wrapped up all neatly. Everyone we met that week was there, even Paul Simonon. Our performance that night was awful, but for us it was as fun as cannonballing into a swimming pool. London is awesome.
The Song That Changed Everything by Michael Diamond, read by Pat Kernan. Sometime in early 1986, we started to focus on making another 12-inch for Def Jam. Even though our first two had sort of been duds, the label was doing really well, and we'd been on tour with Madonna, so there was momentum, even if it hadn't exactly been created by us. Our creative process wasn't complicated. Mostly, we spent a lot of time just hanging out. By now, we were all out of school. Aside from crappy part-time jobs, we really had no responsibilities. When we weren't working, we'd just wander around. No mission and no permission. We'd drink Ballantine ale sheathed in brown paper bags, critique graffiti pieces and tags, listen to music blasting from boxes or cars or large wooden speakers set up in storefronts. All of a sudden, there were rap shows on the radio where there hadn't been before. Great shows like Mr. Magic on WBLS, the Zulu Beach Show on WHBI, and DJ Red Alert on KISS FM. On one of these afternoons, Horvitz and Rick started going back and forth with little bits from the records we loved or just thought were funny. That part at the beginning of Curtis Blow's Christmas Rappin' where he interrupts the Christmas carol by saying, "Hold it now." The way Slick Rick says, "Hit it," at the end of the intro to the Dougie Fresh hit La-Di-Da-Di. That "Yo, Leroy" shout from the Return of Leroy Part 1 by the Jimmy Castor Bunch. Phrases, horn stabs, drum rolls, The more records we bought and listened to, the larger our internal libraries became. We would voraciously consume sounds and lyrics, fractions of a bar, and just get them stuck in our heads. Then, against the backdrop of New York City, they'd come shooting back out of our mouths. So picture some 18-year-old kid walking down the street saying, "Hold it now," in a fake low voice to his friends, and his friends answering back with a high-pitched, "Hit it!" At the time, we were working on and off at a studio called Secret Society. It was up in this maze of a loft building on Lafayette Street in Chinatown. Secret Society essentially had an open-door policy with Rick. The owner didn't need the studio to bring in money because at the time the studio was mostly being used for other purposes. The only people working there legitimately were the people working with Rick, so it wasn't like you had to call up the studio and say, "Well, in regards to our session on Monday," we could just leave our shit there. Drum machines, records, turntables, whatever, and kind of wander in and out. So that was where we went without Rick, and got down to the brass tacks of trying the idea we'd stumbled upon while walking around. A song built around the "Hold It Now" and "Hit It" samples.
When License to Ill was finished, we liked the studio so much that we didn't want other people to start booking it. We wanted the studio to remain like it was, someplace we could just sort of use whenever. So on the album's credit, instead of putting that the music was recorded at Secret Society Studios, we said it was recorded at the Chung King House of Metal. But John King, who owned the studio, hence the name Chung King, outwitted us and just changed the name. Then it immediately became a real professional studio that was booked all the time. It still is.
The first thing Horvitz did was make a drum beat. A few months before, he'd bought a used 12-inch at St. Mark's Sounds, "Let's Get Small" by Trouble Funk. That shit was banging. Trouble Funk was a go-go band. Go-go was the regional music of Washington, D.C. It was a localized variation of funk that could be identified mostly by its rhythms. Kick drums on the upbeats or the ands, with bongos or percussion kind of dancing over the beat. It was instantly recognizable. We loved it. Inspired by Doug E. Fresh's The Show and Trouble Funk and Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers, Horvitz programmed a beat on the DX drum machine that had real go-go swing. We combined that with a simpler 808 beat that had a big sustained kick drum, and then Horvitz scratched in the "Hold It Now" and "Hit It" and "Yo Leroy" parts, as well as the whistle and the horn parts. We were left to our own devices, literally, and loving it. When Rick was producing, he brought a more set agenda and sound into the studio. There was less experimentation. Left alone, we felt comfortable and excited with this new kind of collage format we had stumbled upon. Once it got down to writing the lyrics, we were loose. On our first couple of Def Jam 12-inches, the lyrics were self-conscious. We were trying to sound and write like other rap groups that had come before us. Here, we just started writing about the ridiculous stuff we did and saw. A combination of personal experience and fantasy, but fully our own vision. Our main goal was really just to crack each other up. A bunch of the lines probably make no sense to anyone but us. Like the last one. "Surgeon General cut Professor DJ Figgs." DJ Figgs wasn't an actual DJ. He was just some guy that DJ Run knew. Run would always tell us that Figgs would be a great DJ if he were a DJ. So we name-checked him. Sight unseen. Turns out he couldn't spin, really at all. Which made the whole thing funnier to us. The whole song was like that, just whatever crazy shit we came up with. After a few days, we'd finished putting the song together. Rick came by, and we played it for him. He kind of flipped out. "Don't change anything. It's great. I want to play it for Russell." Russell came over, straight out of the club, and fueled by who knows how many screwdrivers, he flipped out too. "We need to just put this out." We were surprised, but excited. Rick mixed it, making it sound bigger and more professional, just generally more legit. Most important, he made that 808 sound crazy. A few weeks later, the song, now titled "Hold It Now, Hit It," came out as our third 12-inch. Mix shows up and down the East Coast started playing it. It was in record pools. Legit rap DJs really wanted it. We're not talking about the quirky danceteria success of Cookie Puss. Our shit was getting played on hip-hop radio and in real hip-hop clubs, at block parties, in school jams. In this world, no one knew who we were or what we looked like or even where we came from. It didn't matter. What mattered was when the intro to that record dropped and crowds heard that "Hold It Now" phrase followed by the roll and the 808 kick on the verse, they went crazy. You could hear that 808 rattling the rear glass on cars up and down the East Coast. It also detonated many a PA, overloading the low end and making shit just shut right down. In retrospect, "Hold It Now, Hit It" changed everything for us. Instead of trying to act and sound like someone else, we were just being ourselves, writing from our own lives and experiences for the first time since Pollywog's Do. We figured out how to piece together different elements that we loved, beats, samples from our favorite records, turntable scratches, and turn them into a song. We had, in short, found our voice.
MC Shy D and a Dozen Eggs by Adam Horovitz, read by Wanda Sykes. He's very serious about his Cadillac, and he does not fuck around. We were heading to Virginia to play two shows. Russell Simmons was explaining that the promoter of the shows was going to personally pick us up at the airport in his Cadillac. "Do not mess with his car," Russell said. It seemed odd and not a big deal, but okay. We landed in Virginia, walked out to the curbside pickup area, and there he was, the promoter. Kind of a shortish, heaviest gentleman wearing a baby blue tracksuit. He was severely jerry-curled up, like real 80s wet look crazy. He looked like he was in that band Ready for the World, you know, Oh Sheila. Jerry curls were everywhere back then, but not so much in New York City, and for sure not in our mostly white, dressed in black, downtown Manhattan scene. As curious as we were to meet this fabled man, we were even more intrigued by his car. "Hey, thanks for picking us up and for putting on these shows and everything," we said. But we were fucking giddy with anticipation about my man's car. We all squeezed in, and you know what? It was a fucking tore-up mess. If he was so serious about it, why was it such a dump? It had long lost the mystique and elegance of the Cadillac brand. The only really nice Cadillac we'd ever been in was DMC's, which was brand new and nice as shit, with 50 evergreen and vanilla-scented trees hanging from the rearview mirror. But that's neither here nor there, because now we're here, in Virginia, driving in a disappointment, silently pondering our promoter's backstory. We arrived at a kind of shitty motel, and for some reason, there's an air of, "These guys are a bunch of jerk-offs," emanating from our new colleague. Maybe I felt this vibe because there were six of us on this trip, and he got us one room with one bed. Seems weird, right? We asked him why only one room, and he said that he booked another room for our tour manager. Huh? Tour manager? We didn't have one of those. Enter Bill Piedmont. Russell had told the promoter that when we got to Virginia, we'd meet up with our tour manager. It turned out that Mr. Piedmont had just recently, the day before we arrived in Virginia, been released from prison, and Russell was doing his friend a favor by throwing him a couple of bucks and whatnot. What landed Mr. Piedmont in prison was never explained to us. So our promoter actually got two rooms at the motel for us, but Mr. Piedmont took one of them so he could have a reunion with his wife and small toddler child. It was a really fucking weird scene. Also, that's not actually his name. We flew on Piedmont Airlines to get to Virginia, and things were so chaotic that we didn't really get his name, so that's what we called him, Bill Piedmont. Our first show was at a small disco. I can't imagine that it was an advertised event. It seemed more like we just showed up at a disco that was already happening and inserted ourselves into the night. The DJ stopped playing whatever song was playing, probably "Give Me Tonight" by Shannon, and me, Adam, Mike, and Dr. Dre took his place in the DJ booth. Dre got out his instrumental copies of the two songs we were gonna play and started our show. People sort of watched, had their drinks, and we played our two songs, Hold It Now, Hit It, and Slow and Low. We left the DJ booth, and then another rapper, MC Shy D, took our place. He did his two songs, and that was the end of the live performance segment of the night. The club went back to being a half-filled discotheque. What do you do after the disco is done? Go to Waffle House. So we went with our new friend, MC Shy D. He was kind of our first rapper friend outside of New York. We had friends in punk bands from other states like Boston and DC and stuff, and got to know Run and them and a few other rappers from New York. I was really psyched when we met UTFO. But Shy D was a rapper from another place, another state, another world. Atlanta. We ordered our Waffle House late night meals, and when it gets to Shy D, he orders 10 fried eggs. Wait, what? He said, shoot, that's nothing. You should see my DJ. He said his DJ ordered an average of a dozen eggs every time they went to a diner. Remember, when you're around 20 years old, you're at diners often. I don't know if you've seen what 10 fried eggs looks like on a plate at 2 in the morning, but it's a fucking unnerving sight. We went back to our motel room, and me, Adam, Mike, Dr. Dre, and our friends Say and Dave Skilkin discussed what just happened at the Waffle House. And then we picked our spots on the bed and floor and fell asleep. Sometimes you know the show you're about to play is going to potentially suck, but there's something about it, some external details that's going to make it fun, or at least memorable, or perhaps one day worthy of writing in a book. The next day's gig on this Virginia extravaganza is in the afternoon at a roller rink, a place where families go to have fun. This roller rink was not like the Roxy back in Manhattan. The Roxy was ultra New York City. African Bambaataa on the wheels, Rocksteady Crew on the floor. The roller rink in Virginia felt nice and old-timey and very American. Afternoon light filled the room. There's maybe 15 people there, and maybe some of them were there for the show. Dr. Dre went up on the one-foot-high platform of a stage and started the first song. Yacht walked out, grabbed the mic off the mic stand, threw the stand on the floor. Now I chill real ill when I start to chill. Then I walked out, grabbed the mic off the mic stand, and threw the stand on the floor, sipping pints of ale out my windowsill. As Mike headed to his mic stand, out of nowhere, a crazy guy rushed the stage. As he stepped onto the tiny stage, it kind of collapsed. He was attempting to punch Mike, but ended up kind of falling into and onto him and giving him a haymaker-type bonk on the top of his head. Now, in that very moment, from our vantage point, it didn't seem like he was in attack mode. We thought maybe he was trying to be all hardcore and do a one-foot stage dive onto no one. We were just looking at this guy, confused, when we realized that he was not only the sound man who's super angry that we just threw his mic stands around, he's also our Jerry Curl promoter. In an instant, Bill Piedmont rushed the stage and assumed a full-on textbook karate position. He is about to break old Sheila the fuck down. 15 strangers and a roller rink in Virginia were frozen in total suspense. Piedmont, still in karate pose, kind of backed up real slow and corralled us into a side room. Once he got us in there, he closed the door behind him and proceeded to have a full-on freak-out crying meltdown. It was really one of the oddest moments in recorded time. Seriously, all that needed to be said was, hey man, sorry we fucked up your mic stands. If they're broken, we'll get you some new ones. But you know, on TV shows and in movies, no one ever says the easy, normal, rational thing. So we took a cab to the airport and flew home. A few days later, we were hanging out with Run DMC and Jam Master Jay and told them all about the trip. Shy D and all the fucking eggs, the promoter, the Cadillac, Bill Piedmont's breakdown, everything. When we finished our story, Jay asked, did he have juice? What? Who? Shy D. Anyone can eat a dozen eggs. It's the juice that fills you up.
Walk This Way by Adam Horovitz. Rick Rubin was getting ready to start producing Run-DMC's next record, Raising Hell, and he had this idea that they should do a new version of the Aerosmith song Walk This Way. The original version starts with a nice breakbeat, so it'd be an interesting idea to use that and see what a rap version would sound like. He took it a step further and contacted Joe Perry and Steve Tyler from Aerosmith to see if they'd want to play guitar and sing the chorus on this new Run-DMC version. They said yes. There was no way we were going to miss that shit, so we made sure to be in the studio when they recorded it. Joe Perry seemed just like what you think he'd be like. Do you think about Joe Perry a lot? He seemed quiet, cool, and laid back in the cut. Steve Tyler was also just what you'd think he'd be like. He did not stop talking the entire time. He wasn't really making sense and would randomly just start scatting, like boogity-woogity-boo type stuff. Run, D, and Jay were kind of loving it, like, who the fuck is this ancient court jester wearing silk clothing and 30 scarves? He's definitely making us laugh, uncomfortably, but wait, Rick, you're sure this is a good idea, right? I don't know if you've ever been in a room or on a random small town street somewhere, and it's just you, a really famous person, and one other person that's uncontrollably screaming or crying with excitement and disbelief at seeing that famous person, is really awkward. Going to do anything with Run-DMC in 1986 in America was bizarre. They were fucking huge. We'd go with them to a restaurant, mall, gas station, whatever, and people would come running from their houses and apartments and leave work to see them because word of mouth started spreading around the neighborhood that they were there. People would freak the fuck out. They were so large that by the time their Raising Hell tour got to Miami, the promoters upgraded their venue from basketball arena to baseball stadium. Thousands and thousands of people. Joe Perry and Steve Tyler were flying down to Miami just to do the song with them. It was bound to be a fucking spectacle. We were one of the opening bands on that tour, and Yauch, for whatever reason, happened to have a bass with him, and someone, probably Jam Master Jay, said it would be okay for him to play bass with them and Aerosmith for the big song on stage in a baseball stadium in Miami. Yes. Steve Tyler and Joe Perry didn't do a sound check, and so they had no idea who Yauch was. Cut to the big moment when Aerosmith is about to hit the stage to join Run-DMC to play the number one song on the entire planet. They walk out, and the crowd goes wild. But now there's also some other guy on stage, Yauch, and he was lit up. We all were, super drunk all day, waiting for this moment. And Yauch fucking delivered, majestically. The look on the Aerosmith guy's faces was fantastic bemusement. Who is this dirty drunk guy on stage, and why is he playing bass with us? Throughout the whole song, Yauch kept trying to go back-to-back rock guitar player style with Joe Perry, who was having none of it. It basically turned into Yauch chasing him around the stage, running backwards after him. And all of us on the side of the stage, watching, screaming, laughing, and loving it. Not for nothing, but I feel like there was always a spin on Walk This Way that Aerosmith was this big, huge band that blew Run-DMC up. This little-known group with this new sound called rap music, as if Run and them would be nowhere without Aerosmith. Yes, the original Walk This Way was an insanely big record, but Aerosmith's days of being an arena rock band were behind them. No offense, but no one really gave a shit about them in 1986. If it wasn't for Run-DMC doing that song with them, who knows what would have become of Aerosmith. I mean, shit, we might not have ever had to endure Love in an Elevator or Dude Looks Like a Lady. Thanks a lot, Rick Rubin, for your brilliant fucking ideas.
Perhaps the shortest headlining gig in history. By Michael Diamond, read by Rosie Perez. August 1986. We were playing the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum Arena on the Raising Hell Tour and playing our first ever L.A. headlining gig later that same night. The plan was that we'd get off stage in Oakland at around 7:45, fly to L.A., and play a late show at the club Power Tools, which was located in an amazing old ballroom at the former Park Plaza Hotel on MacArthur Park. At the time, Power Tools was to L.A., what Zia Zativia was to New York City, an underground nightclub that catered to art students, aspiring musicians, club kids, and everything in between. We were psyched. Playing two shows on the same night in different cities was like some Phil Collins Live Aid type shit to us, especially if one of the gigs was headlining an underground club. The people from Power Tools told us that a driver would be waiting for us at LAX, so when we landed, we were on a lookout for like a driver in a suit holding a placard. Instead, we were greeted by a short kid who legit looked 12 years old. His hair was brushed back rocker style, and he was wearing a leather jacket. Instead of making him look older, though, all of that made him look even younger, like a kid sporting a Grease costume for Halloween. His name was Max Perlick, and he was driving this ginormous white Chrysler Imperial. I'm sure he didn't actually sit on phone books to see over the steering wheel, but that was the vibe. On the way to the club, he told us we needed to buy booze for the DJ booth. To us, this was already an odd task. Like, what club wouldn't have that squared away before now? But then, instead of just walking into the liquor store, Max had to ask people walking in and out of the store to buy the booze for him. He was only 18, and he definitely didn't look like he could pass for 21.
Horovitz and I were only 19 and 20 then. Yauch would have just turned 22, but obviously he didn't feel like volunteering for this mission.
It took a while for someone to say yes. While we waited and then drove to the club, Max regaled us with various tallish tales, the kind that I later discovered were his forte. He was a successful character actor, as in, that was literally his job. But Max was fundamentally an LA club kid, a real music fan. Like, if it were this day and age, he'd be a DJ. In that era, even though he knew a lot and had tons of vinyl, Max was just an actor who was really into music. Soon we were up in the DJ booth having some drinks. Power Tools was packed. The DJ and co-owner mastermind of the club was a guy named Matt Dyke. That night, he played everything from Junkyard Band to Dougie Fresh to Led Zeppelin. People were into it. We were getting all psyched, thinking, wow, we are finally getting to kill it, headlining our own show in L.A. It didn't hurt that the place was packed with beautiful L.A. women who we imagined meeting immediately following our soon-to-be triumphant gig. In the audience, we'd find out later, were musicians from Fishbone and Jane's Addiction, kindred spirits who made up an L.A. scene similar to ours in New York. Bob Forrest, the singer of Thelonious Monster, was running sound for our show. Right before we went on stage, a dude with long straight hair bum-rushed us and said, "Hi, I'm Anthony. I'm going to say something and introduce you guys." Before we could even react, he went on stage and read some spoken word thing that we couldn't hear anyway. The guy, we soon realized, was Anthony Kiedis from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, with whom we played a show earlier that year. Then DJ Hurricane played some kind of intro, and we went on stage as he dropped Slow and Low. Then we started rapping. The sound was utter garbage. We could barely hear the music. Our vocals were way too loud. And any time we all rapped at the same time, the whole thing got distorted and the sound started to cut out entirely. Bob Forrest, by his own admission, was not a sound man. He definitely didn't know hip-hop or understand low-end or 808 kick drums. Somehow we made it through that first song, but on the very first beat of the next one, Hold It Now, Hit It, when that 808 kick drum dropped, the entire PA blew out. Completely gone. Now, by this point in our careers, we played a good batch of shows and had some kind of idea of what they took both musically and professionally. So, when the entire sound system got blown while we played a headlining gig to 1,500-ish paid audience members, did we tap into that reservoir of professionalism and experience to get the problem worked out? No, we most certainly did not. Transcript of our stage banter during the first song.
Yo, man, what the fuck is wrong with you? Turn the music up. I don't know about you, but in New York, we're not a bunch of suckers. Did I say that?
Transcript of our stage banter after the PA blew. We gotta get out of here. Yo, the sound system sucks my dick. No offense to anybody. Y'all come down to the Palladium on Monday. We gonna kick some fucking ass. And then we left. A few things happened in the club after we took off, which we wouldn't find out about until years later, that had a far greater impact on our trajectory as a band than the disastrous show itself. One of the angry attendees we left behind was a young engineer and musician named Mario Caldaro, who tracked down Matt Dyke and his co-owner, John Sadell, and said, "This place is a joke. I have a PA system. I should set up my PA at your club, and you need to let me run the PA and the sound." Matt hired Mario on the spot. Power 2's closed the following year, but by then, Matt wanted to start recording as a producer. So Mario started bringing some of his recording equipment over to Matt's apartment in a shady part of Hollywood and became his engineer. That crap apartment was where Matt co-wrote and produced massive hits for Tone Loke, Wild Thing, Funky Cole Medina, and Young MC, Bust a Move. It was there that we later made most of our second album. Before all that, though, we needed to make our first.
Here's a little story I got to tell. Me, Adam, and Mike were sitting on the stoop outside a random studio that Russell had booked for us. On 21st Street between Broadway and Park, we were waiting for Run DMC. The plan was for us to write and record a song together. It was probably 9 p.m., probably summertime. We probably had bags of beers. What I know for sure is that I was thinking, as we sat there waiting on that stoop, just a couple of years ago, me and Dave Skilkin got busted for writing graffiti. So we ran in here from the police in the stairwell, leading to a basement, two doors down from where we're sitting right now. And here we are, waiting to record a song with the greatest of all time, Run DMC. We were sitting there on that stoop, with our probable bags of beers, waiting in fucking psyched anticipation. Then we heard a sound, a voice. It was getting louder. We looked down the block, and it was Run. He turned the corner and was now barreling towards us, screaming, "Here's a little story I got to tell." Over and over, Run was total walking comic mania. Him and his brother Russell, frantic energy. They must have been insane toddlers. Run caught up to us, way out of breath. We saw D far behind him, turned the corner and slowly stride toward our stoop. "Here's a little story I got to tell. The song will be like a story. Your story. Here's a little story I got to tell about three bad brothers you know so well. It started way back in history with Ad Rock, MCA, and me, Mike D." DMC walked up. "Yep, that's it. That's the intro." So remember, the three of us were just sitting there on the stoop, and there's Run fucking DMC wearing their Run DMC outfits, hats and all. They were standing right there, seemingly almost excited as we were. And they were giving us an intro to a song. Me, Adam, and Mike are trying to contain our exhilaration. When LeBron James passes you the ball, you don't just hold it and yell, "Oh my God, LeBron James just passed me the ball." No. You cross the motherfucker over who's trying to guard you, and you drive to the lane furiously. We all went up to the recording studio and began the process of writing and recording a rap song. Make a beat, record that beat to tape, and then record yourself rapping over that beat. It was lucky for us and Suzuki Samurais throughout the country that we thought to bring my Roland TR-808 drum machine with us. We were talking about what the beat should be like, and Yah, seemingly out of nowhere, like a thousand other ideas of his, said, "Let's just make a simple pattern. We'll flip the tape over and record the drum machine backwards." We all look at him like Shaggy on Scooby-Doo. "Huh?" "Yeah. You flip the reel-to-reel tapes upside down, press play on the drum machine, and play and record on the tape deck.
Then after 3 to 5 minutes, stop recording, flip the tape right upside, and listen back. The drum machine will have recorded it backwards. It was fucking magical. And very typical of Adam Yacht. Oh yeah, I heard you could pull a rabbit out of a hat, and so here's an elephant. Up until that moment, in 1986, there had never been a beat that sounded as funky, fresh, dope, hype, or deaf, whatever the fuck you want to call it. It was that thing that killed John Wayne. We never said this word back then, but really, the Paul Revere beat that Yacht made was fucking awesome. The beat was so nice that we must have just gotten lost in it, because we didn't actually record any vocals that night. We probably just drank 40s with Run and D, and then we walked down to the Palladium, knowing that we'd be back at Chung King to finish the song very soon. We hadn't forgot our priorities. Music can wait. Drink tickets and digits were more important. A few nights later, Rick and I were walking around, hanging out, and I was yelling to him how great that beat in the studio with Run and D was, and how Yacht made this crazy fucking beat, and Run was screaming, "Here's a little story," to Manhattan passerbys. All of it. We were sitting on the stoops of St. Mark's Sound Record Store, and I had my little rhyme book and pen on me. So me and Rick started writing this little story we had to tell. The horse's name, Paul Revere. Comes from Guys and Dolls, but you know that already. I know how deep into show tunes you are. We had just seen the movie Once Upon a Time in the West and really liked it. We were in the Western kind of mode. So of course, now, we're High Plains Drifters.
We Liked It, We Hated It by Michael Diamond. After we moved out of 59 Christie, I found a place on Barrow Street in the West Village. The apartment itself was a second floor walk-up above a bar. Not a glamorous bar at all. Kind of like a cop FedEx guy hangout. The jukebox speakers were right below my bedroom. That shit would get fucking loud on Friday and Saturday nights, blasting Bob Seger and Loverboy until 4 in the morning. But it wasn't a bad apartment, and we started meeting there to write. I had a stereo, and I hooked up an 808 drum machine and a Tascam 4-track cassette recorder to it, and the three of us started to make demos. We'd sit around drinking tall boys and coming up with ideas. One came from listening to a Motorhead live album called No Sleep Till Hammersmith. We started batting that name around and came up with the idea of writing this fantasy song about being a huge touring rock band and our hard life on the road. The joke was that we were like the opposite of big. I mean, we'd played 3 headlining shows outside of New York City, so all the stuff we put in there was a fantasy version of us as cliched rock stars. Even the title, No Sleep Till Brooklyn, was a joke. Brooklyn is now the hipster capital of the world, but at the time, much of the BK was infamous in the hip-hop world because it was so rough and dangerous that literally no rap shows could get booked there. Similarly, the new style was a fantasy version of our actual lives. I mean, cooling on the corner on a hot summer's day? Yes. A lot of beer, a lot of girls, and a lot of cursing? Maybe. Sometimes. A 2-2 automatic on my person? Maybe not so much. One of the things that would serve us well throughout our careers was that we'd usually all sit around and write lyrics together. We'd write for a bit, and then almost like we were playing a game of Boggle, decide that some arbitrary, self-imposed timer had gone off, and it was time to read aloud what we had. This could be both intimidating and frustrating. One of us might have a rhyme that we really liked, but that didn't mean the other two guys would vote it in. As ruthless as this process could be, we became each other's best editors. After inferior lines were vetoed, we'd then organize the mutually approved bits and divide up who was saying what. So as opposed to me writing my own parts, Adam writing his, and so on, all of us co-authored and then divided up the lines after we'd voted on what should stay. In the process, we stumbled upon what defined License to Ill. Fantasies of a life that we pretended to have, delivered in interweaving, accented, occasionally doubled and tripled vocals. We loved The Treacherous Three, Funky Four Plus One More, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and of course, Run DMC so much that we couldn't wait to switch off rhymes and double lyrics like our heroes had before us. Old school crew style. The recording process, writing lyrics on Barrow Street, going into Chungking to try music ideas, honing everything into songs that we were happy with, took place over a few months in the spring of 1986. We were becoming more confident as songwriters. The only time there was doubt was at the end of making the record, and that was the regular creative doubt you get when you're finishing something up and you're like, God, is this really good enough? Does it suck? 'Cause I don't know. I can't even tell anymore. I've listened to